Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Democrats, Republicans, and the White House have so far failed to agree on an extension of the unemployment benefits that have been the safety net for so many Americans during this pandemic. Today on the program, we'll speak with Senator Maggie Hassan about what she finds important in these negotiations, which will continue today. We'll also spend some time reviewing the big stories of the week. You can send your questions or comments right now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And Senator Hassan, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, the Senate rejected two competing proposals. This comes as the $600 weekly boost for unemployment benefits expires today. This is a critical issue to so many Granite Staters feeling the impact. Do you feel like Congress failed by not having the package ready in time for this deadline?
Well, look, we are facing unprecedented crises, a public health crisis that has fed and caused an economic crisis, the worst public health crisis in 100 years, and the worst economic crisis certainly since the Great Depression. And we need a package of relief that will meet the magnitude of both of these crises. And the fact that we would need an additional package has been clear to a number of us for weeks now. And we have been pushing here, Democrats in the Senate, we've been pushing Leader Mitch McConnell to come to the table and negotiate a bipartisan package with us for weeks. Finally, this week, he unveiled a package of proposals that just don't provide the kind of relief, both on the economic front as well as the public health front, that we know we need to continue to work to weather this crisis. The package that we rejected yesterday wouldn't have provided critical funding and support for nursing homes, for state and local governments. It didn't do enough to support individuals and small businesses who are out of work or facing a great economic challenge because of the pandemic. And it shortchanged schools and withholds money to schools if they don't reopen for in-person instruction. So we need to keep working. We need to come together and extend critical individual and small business relief, as well as invest in the kind of public health response that we need, support our state and local governments, and support our schools.
I want to dive into some of the details of what you just mentioned, but I did want to ask about what Republicans have proposed, which is cutting down the $600 in weekly benefits to $200, saying $600 a week was too generous and it kept people from returning to work because they were making more on unemployment. Do Republicans have a point there?
You know, what is critical here and what we've been hearing from constituents all over New Hampshire and all over the country is that enhanced unemployment, it was enhanced eligibility, as well as an enhanced amount, has been a critical lifeline, not only for families who need to pay their rent and put food on the table, but it's also acted as an economic stimulus, according to the economists we've talked to. We certainly have been hearing from small businesses some of the concerns that you just raised. And I think what's really critical here moving forward is that we have important and adequate unemployment benefits for people who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own because of this pandemic, but that we also have federal and state safety standards so that businesses can reopen and workers can be confident that they can go back to work safely. The other component here that is really necessary in terms of getting people back to work is investing in our childcare centers and our schools so that parents can get back to work because they know their children are in a safe place and learning. So there's a lot of component pieces to this, but the balance we need to strike here is helping people continue to stay in their homes and feed their families and engage in commerce while also making sure that we have plans to allow people to return safely to work.
Mm-hmm. You've been calling for more help for municipalities that may be feeling the pandemic budget pinch. Is there an amount you'd like to see in the next package to be set aside for cities and towns in New Hampshire?
Well, I think it's really important for everybody to take a step back and think about why our cities and towns and our state need help from the federal government and from this administration. Back in March or so, all across the country, state and local governments did what the administration asked them to do. They essentially shut down large portions of their economy in order to save lives. That was the right thing to do. But as they did it, they knew that that would mean that their revenues would take a huge hit. And those revenues fund essential services like law enforcement, like teachers, like public health workers. And so now state and local governments are faced with this huge decline in revenues just at a time when their services are needed most. So we need to actually assess what those revenue losses have looked like, what state and local governments need from the federal government in order to keep operating and supporting their communities during this pandemic. And we also have to realize that if we don't help state and local governments, they will be forced to engage in huge layoffs, something some of them have already had to do. That not only undermines the services that they need to provide, but it undermines our economic recovery as well as it increases unemployment. So the HEROES Act, which the House passed now back on May 15th, had, I think, $900+ billion towards state and local relief. I think we need to be looking at what state and local governments tell us they need and then have robust bipartisan discussions about what the right number is.
And we've been hearing a lot about people worried about staying in their homes, renters worried about paying rent. One element of the relief package could be the focus on those folks. To what extent should this next package help people keep up with their rent and mortgage payments?
You know, that's another thing we are hearing about from economists as well as advocates for more affordable housing. And we're certainly hearing about it from housing experts and advocates in New Hampshire. There is a proposal on the table that a lot of us think should be part of the package that would provide $100 billion nationally in rent relief. Again, that helps people make those rental program payments, stay in their homes. That also obviously gets money in the hands of landlords. And we know many apartment owners are small business people themselves. They need their revenue stream too. So this is a way to keep people in their homes, keep the economy moving during this difficult time. And I hope that a final package will include rent relief.
Listeners, we're speaking with Senator Maggie Hassan about negotiations in Congress about another relief package to address some of the stress brought about through the coronavirus pandemic. If you have questions or comments, give us a call now so we can put your question to Senator Hassan. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. When it comes to beating back the pandemic, Senator Hassan, you've called for a public health approach. What do you mean by that?
Well, look, what we have seen, and I think what everybody now knows through experience in this pandemic, is that we can't recover economically without also waging the kind of public health effort that will contain this virus. We will only recover economically when people feel safe in going out and about and re-engaging in commerce, getting back on public transportation, going back to restaurants and gyms. And in order for that to happen, we have to have the kind of testing resources that we need. We have to have contact tracing resources. We have to have the appropriate amount of personal protective equipment. I have been calling on the president really since the pretty much the beginning of this pandemic to do some basic things that would really help us meet this moment. First and foremost, we need to have a testing program where the United States is producing enough tests and has enough of the supplies that you need to administer those tests so that we can not only test people who are symptomatic, but we can test people randomly all across the country to track the spread of this disease and then take appropriate action. That also requires investments in contact tracing, which means hiring and training people to be contact tracers. It also means invoking something that only the president can do, which is called the Defense Production Act, to help both produce more tests here in the United States, but produce more personal protective equipment, and then take the measures that we need to distribute it according to priority need for people on the front lines. Right now, for instance, we're still having hearings about the weaknesses in our personal protective equipment or PPE supply chain at a time when not only do healthcare institutions need more PPE as we're seeing surges around the country, but our schools are trying to reopen and they're going to need PPE. Our businesses are trying to reopen, they need PPE. Lastly, the president should be setting an example by wearing a mask whenever he is in public, whenever he is in meetings, and the people around him should be wearing masks too. We know that wearing masks saves lives, and we know that we need to do more to educate folks about the fact that when you wear a mask, it's protecting other people, and when they wear a mask, it's protecting you. So those are some of the things we need to continue to focus on, and I'll keep pushing for.
Well, and when you say pushing for it, you mean are you pushing for more money to supply states with testing supplies?
Yes, one of the pieces of the next relief package that I've been pushing for is robust and significant funding for more testing, more supplies for that testing, more personal protective equipment, more contact tracers.
Mm-hmm. With respect to masks, you've been governor of New Hampshire. Our current governor, Chris Sununu, is the only one in New England who has not instituted a mandatory mask wearing requirement in all public spaces. If you were governor now, would you issue such a mask mandate?
You know, this is a place where I do differ with Governor Sununu. I think it's really important to do everything we can to increase mask wearing. And so one of the things we know is that when you pass a mask requirement or order that everybody wear masks, that more people do it. And it also conveys how important it is to our public health and to our economic recovery. So, you know, one of the personal experiences I have, I've been based down in DC most of the time over the last couple of weeks. And the mayor here recently ordered mask wearing, and more people are wearing masks now than they were before she did. And it's just that basic and that simple.
Governor Sununu says such a mask mandate would be hard to enforce. Does that ring true to you?
Look, I think there are a number of laws that we have that can be hard to enforce. The issue is what kind of message are you sending? And when the New Hampshire governor or the state of New Hampshire says everybody must wear a mask in certain circumstances, and you have exclusions for young children, for people whose health would prevent it, for people in certain situations. But when you make the statement that it is so important to do that we are requiring it, it reinforces to people that this is a way that they can slow the spread of a deadly disease that is not only taking lives, but also wreaking havoc with our economy.
You took part in a virtual roundtable earlier this week with educators to talk about the decision over school reopening. Communities across the state are taking different approaches to this. What did you hear in that virtual roundtable, and how, if at all, can Congress help?
Well, what I heard first and foremost was educators along with some school, a school board member and a parent, all of whom want what we all do, which is to get kids back to school. And also I heard educators who just are very focused on how they can do best by these students during this difficult time, both in terms of providing critical quality instruction to them, but also supporting them socially and emotionally during what is just a topsy-turvy time for kids, to put it mildly, a really difficult time for kids. And so, but the other thing I heard was their concerns that there isn't clear guidance from federal and state authorities about precisely what it is they should be doing in certain circumstances that may occur because of the pandemic. I also heard that they need more resources, that the resources that were provided to them in the CARES Act, while appreciated, didn't go very far. And, you know, I'd ask listeners to think about this. If you are trying to reopen your school for at least some in-person instruction, it requires reconfiguring of classrooms, in some cases, new equipment. If you're going to have desks for each student, a lot of our classrooms for young kids, for instance, don't have that right now. You have to provide a different kind of and more frequent sanitation services. You have to reconfigure the way you deliver school meals to students. All of that is very costly. You also have to expand your broadband capacity, not only to make sure that people engaged in remote learning, if you're doing remote learning or if you're doing a hybrid program, can connect to the school platforms adequately, but some of the schools are planning to have kids do more of their classwork online, even in the school, so that they can cut down on the amount of physical transfer between classrooms that happens. So all of these things are costly. All of these things take planning and some new approaches, and in some cases, some new and additional personnel. And that's why I think it's so important that we provide more resources to schools in the next package, and why it's so important that state and federal officials do more to provide precise guidance about what schools should do in certain circumstances.
Our time is short here, Senator Hassan, but as we close, I did want to ask you what the next steps in the negotiations on this relief bill would be and when you think Granite Staters might expect a deal to be reached.
Well, I know talks are ongoing between Democratic leadership in the House and Senate and the White House. I hope that Senator McConnell will join those talks. We really need to make sure that we're coming together and looking at what the people on the ground all across the country are telling us is needed in order to weather this crisis. This is unprecedented, worst economic crisis we've seen since the Depression, and certainly the worst health crisis in 100 years. And we need to come together, have these bipartisan discussions, listen to the economists and the health experts who are giving us very precise recommendations and quite unified recommendations about what we should do. And we need to come together and do it. I am hopeful. The talks have been picking up in frequency and intensity recently, and we know how important this relief is to our constituents. I certainly know how important it is to Granite Staters, and I'm going to keep pushing to get it done.
Well, Senator Maggie Hassan, thank you very much for speaking with me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay safe and be well.
You too. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Usually at this time, we've been speaking with primary candidates. We will resume that series of interviews with a conversation with Democratic candidate for governor and executive counselor Andrew Valinsky. Tune in to the Weekly News Roundup next week for that conversation. Still to come today, we'll speak with state reporters on a variety of issues in the news this week, including Governor Sununu's refusal to institute a statewide mask mandate. Let us know what you think. Send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Monday on The Exchange, reassessing Hannah Duston. As the Black Lives Matter movement inspires a reconsideration of Confederate statues, Native Americans are now calling for a reexamination of Duston's statue in Boscawen, New Hampshire. Her tale of Native slaughter made her a colonial-era heroine, but controversial in our time. Now there's an effort underway to tell the full story, which includes keeping the statue. Join us for The Exchange Monday morning, live at 9 on NHPR. Right now, we're taking a look back at the big headlines of both the day and the week. And speaking of the headline of the day, discussion of the COVID-19 relief package that is still in the works in D.C., Joe in Rochester shared his comments via email. Joe says, "Why am I not hearing about investment in infrastructure in the COVID spending? We need investment in bridges, roads, internet, etc. And if we were to spend in this area, we would have employment, spending on equipment, materials, etc., thus helping individuals and businesses." Catherine also wrote in to say, "Could we fund a program working with our talented artists and artists in residence to help convey messages and bring hope, spirit, and joy into underserved communities, towns, parks, cities, and schools. If you have questions or comments about the week's news, if you have something to say about that COVID-19 relief package, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Right now, we are joined by NHPR's Annie Ropeek. She's energy and environment reporter and lead reporter on NHPR's new climate reporting project, By Degrees, and also Ethan DeWitt, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today.
Good morning.
Great to be on.
So, Ethan, we just heard from Senator Hassan on the $600 weekly unemployment benefit ending today. You've been listening to the conversation. Was there anything about what she said that stood out to you?
Well, I think she kind of underscored what the sort of bigger picture is in Washington right now. There seems to be a divide between doing something quickly and doing something kind of expansively. And that would definitely be the divide that you see between the Democrats and Republicans in Congress. So there was a White House proposal that, you know, you had asked her about that would extend the $600 federal unemployment benefit boost for a short term while the sides negotiate. Democrats have rejected that. And their position, and I think Senator Hassan articulated it, is that there should be, you know, it should be more than a small fix. There should be another big relief program.
The small fix, by the way, would have been 4 months of the extension of the $600 a week unemployment benefits. The Democrats preferred to have that extended through the first quarter of 2021, and they also wanted it tied to other provisions like the ones she described, that, you know, funding for cities and towns, et cetera.
Yes. So there's a sense of strategy here where the Democrats feel that if they do any sort of shorter term extension and don't advocate for some of these bigger items, that they won't get them. But I should note that the stakes are very high and the implications are very high. So there's a lot of talk nationally about how the $600 extra benefit that comes along with an unemployment claim that has existed throughout the pandemic, that is ending this week. But actually, in New Hampshire, it already has ended. The authority to send out the checks for New Hampshire ended July 25th. So this week, it is gone. And this is the first week that families are not able to access that those who are unemployed are not going to be receiving that check. So for New Hampshire, the stakes are very real and they are immediate. This is happening now. And so that may, that certainly will be a factor in Washington, but it's definitely kind of making its mark here in New Hampshire now.
What about evictions? Are they looming as a result of the loss of this extra funding for people who may have fallen on hard times?
I think the short answer to that is it's unclear right now. Everything's unclear, but housing advocates are sounding the alarm. They've been sounding the alarm for weeks. They've been doing this for weeks. They're calling this week coming up and this month coming up the, quote, perfect storm for evictions. There's a few things coming on. I think one of the major factors is this $600 benefit essentially going away, which has, you know, proved a boon for families who are trying to pay back rent, et cetera. But there are a few other state factors there as well. There was a ban on evictions that expired July 1st. Around the end of June, we asked the governor about that expiration, and he said that he was not worried about a wave of evictions that might come out of that for two reasons. One reason is that he extended the period for which a tenant can be served a writ of eviction. So usually it's 7 days. He extended it to 30. So under his executive order, those orders cannot go out for 30 days after, the landlord decides that, you know, they want to evict. So that was one extension. And then the other one is he created a $35 million fund that would assist tenants and homeowners, and you can apply for up to $2,500 in relief. So these are two things. And Sunia said it would be an off-ramp for this, for the eviction moratorium for those who are looking to pay their rent. The issue is that we are now near the end of that 30 days after the moratorium was lifted on July 1st. So we're getting to the point where those eviction writs, the landlords can now start going to the court and they can start serving those writs, which will then start the court process. The second issue is that relief money that's going through the state is taking a little bit of time to get going. There have been thousands of applications and there's only been a small proportion of that has been awarded so far. So you have that plus unemployment, the federal unemployment, and you just have a range of factors that are all kind of coalescing around the same 2-week period And that's sort of why advocates are saying this is a perfect storm. But of course, it's unclear how it will play out.
And why today is such a critical moment for Congress to pass something that will provide a backstop for those who are having a hard time right now. Annie Ropeek, I wanted to ask you about something else that happened in New Hampshire this week. Governor Sununu announced he was lifting the ban on reusable bags at grocery stores. Did he give any rationale for this change, Annie?
Yeah, he said he had talked to public health officials and considered our current coronavirus rates and decided it was the right time to do this. You know, this might seem like a small thing in the grand scheme. That's sort of how Sununu has phrased it when asked about it in the past, asked why he isn't prioritizing doing this. And, you know, I think even environmental advocates understand that there are, you know, more sort of life and death concerns to deal with. But there's a lot of sort of symbolic value in this change. And I think Sununu had heard a lot of pressure from the zero waste community, from frustrated shoppers, and, you know, who are having their bag balls growing in their homes day by day and are sick of having to bag their own groceries at their car if they don't want to use plastic. And he decided this was the right time to make that change.
And speaking of safety precautions that we've been taking publicly, New Hampshire is now the only state in New Hampshire without a mandatory mask requirement for public spaces where social distancing isn't possible. Governor Sununu has maintained that he doesn't think the state should issue a mask wearing mandate right now.
It's hard to go out now and not see a vast number of people wearing masks. I think we've really been very successful in that with our messaging.
Ethan, Governor Sununu saying because so many people are wearing masks voluntarily, the state doesn't need to issue an order.
Yeah, and this has been a position that really hasn't changed from the beginning with the ebb and flow of this virus. It has the argument that the governor has consistently used is that this is very hard to enforce and thus would kind of do more harm than good. It may kind of inspire a defiance, has been something that he's talked about. But again, as you noted, we are the only state right now in New England that doesn't have a mask requirement. And there are other areas where this is showing through as well. For instance, school reopening plans. All of our surrounding states require masks in schools. In the governor's voluntary guidance for schools, there is no requirement. School districts are, of course, allowed to set their own mask mandates, and many of them are doing so. But it's another example where I think New Hampshire's governor has decided that, you know, there needs to be more deference to people's choices rather than actually kind of a regulation around this. And it's creating, I think, some pushback, especially in the wake of the canceled Trump rally that was expected in Portsmouth earlier this month. Mm-hmm. That was one area that kind of proved to be a breaking point, and I think kind of move the conversation along, and you're seeing some more effort by particularly Democrats to try to bring about a mask mandate. You've seen it in the state house where they voted to require masks in the state house for all people coming in to legislative work, notably not the governor's office, which they don't have jurisdiction over. Mm-hmm. And then, but you are still seeing this debate playing out. And this week there was a vote by the Legislative Advisory Committee for the Reopening Commission, the Gopher Committee, and it split along party lines. There's a 4-4 vote on whether to even recommend that there be a mask mandate. So I think you're seeing it as a very partisan issue.
And there are several towns considering their own mask requirements. NHPR's Daniela Ali reports 3 communities in the Upper Valley, Lebanon, Hanover, and Enfield, will discuss issuing mandatory mask wearing next week. Julia Griffin is Hanover's town manager. She says as the town gets ready for about 2,000 Dartmouth students to arrive on campus this fall, she wants to ensure that students are also wearing masks off campus since they're required to do so on campus.
That population is coming in from all over the world, and consequently just introducing the possibility of a much larger number of virus vectors, as everybody calls individual folks.
So, Ethan, are you hearing anything about mask mandates on the town level?
Not personally. I haven't done that reporting, but I do know that, you know, in Portsmouth, for instance, as another example, again, looking at that Trump rally, which is ultimately postponed due to weather, that kind of inspired a conversation that has kind of pushed the ball forward in Portsmouth. But I don't think you're necessarily seeing a tipping point yet among towns. I think certainly towns are looking at it. but it isn't yet a widespread movement that where you might see a majority of towns with a mandate. But certainly cities are discussing it.
Mm-hmm. On to another piece of news. Yesterday, we saw Governor Sununu push back quite assertively to President Trump's notion of delaying the November election. Governor Sununu said something he says the president does not have the authority to do alone. What exactly did the governor say about this, Ethan?
Sure. The governor kind of came out pretty early in the day. This was something that, was prompting a lot of reaction yesterday. But I believe the governor was, he's one of the first Republican governors definitely to come forward. And I think the Governors Association, I'm forgetting the exact acronym, retweeted his tweet. And it was sort of like a moment yesterday where it was clear that this was not going to be a popular idea among Republicans. Sununu just said that it was very simple. The election would be held. The election has been held. And in his statement, he also kind of provided a defense of the election, of New Hampshire's election. And there was a little bit of a subtext there. President Trump has called into question New Hampshire's elections. He has falsely claimed that there is evidence of voters being bused in from Massachusetts. Our own Secretary of State did a kind of review of that and found that to be false and unfounded. And within Sununu's statement was kind of a statement saying New Hampshire has always had safe, secure, elections, and that wouldn't change coming this November.
And really quickly, Ethan, a UNH Survey Center poll found presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden leading President Trump by a 53-40 margin in New Hampshire. Any surprises with that?
To be honest, I have not been kind of following that poll, but it definitely does track with other polls we've seen in other states. But I haven't really looked at the implications of that in New Hampshire.
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And still to come, the state is launching a broad effort to find ways to improve air emissions in New Hampshire. We're going to get the details. NHPR's Annie Ropeek is still with us, so we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about a few other news stories as well. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and with me now, Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter and lead reporter on NHPR's new climate reporting project, By Degrees, and Ethan DeWitt, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. Let's start with you, Annie. The state announced this week that it plans to review the ventilation systems at long-term care facilities where there have been coronavirus outbreaks. You covered this. What are the details of this?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So there's increasing science that suggests that coronavirus may be spread more through the air than we previously realized, that these droplets could linger in the air, that they could linger on ventilation systems. So vents, ducting potentially. And this is all still sort of an emerging area of research, but the state is taking this first step to look at the kinds of ventilation systems that are at all of these long-term care homes where there have been coronavirus cases. They want to see what kinds of ventilation those homes have, kind of compare that to where physically in the building there have been coronavirus cases, and put together some data that they can use to look at homes where there have not been outbreaks to see if they can see any connections and potentially predict some risks for those homes just related to the ventilation systems. And state officials were sure to note that this was not a compliance issue. They say they've been inspecting all these homes throughout the pandemic. This is not a question of whether these ventilation systems are, so to speak, up to code. And they're not looking at necessarily other deficiencies in their handling of coronavirus. They're just looking at what system exists in the building, how does it relate to cases that have been in the building, and can they derive any conclusions from that about how the ventilation systems may be contributing to the spread of the virus.
I see. And how long is the state expecting this review to take?
They launched it, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday, and it's going to take 2 weeks. So we are a week into it now. And they didn't say exactly how that data was going to be released. They're going to put together some data that they are then going to use to look at homes where there haven't been outbreaks. So I think we should stay tuned for this in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Well, we'll check in with you again on this. Ethan DeWitt, I wanted to ask you if you could give us a quick rundown of the bills that Governor Sununu took action on this week.
Sure. So as we kind of started to see a pattern of, there were a fair few vetoes. it's kind of going to be difficult to compare this to last year, in which there were a record 55 vetoes, given that a lot of these bills are merged into one, and so there are fewer bills to deal with. But there are also signatures as well. And there were there was a few omnibus bills, packaged bills under themes. There's an education bill that he signed. There was a veterans bill. The education bill helped fund full-day kindergarten funding and also requires child sexual abuse prevention, education, and training in schools. The veterans, this is something that was supported by Senator John Morgan. It creates something that he calls a veterans bill of rights. And among that is a prohibition against higher education institutions from discriminating in the military. Sununu has also signed this bill that's sort of known in some areas as the Ban the Box bill. This would have required it would prevent public employers from questioning potential applicants on their criminal background on the written application instead of in person. The idea being that they shouldn't be categorically denied, but should be given a chance to talk about it in their interview. That was limited to public employees and not private employees, but the governor signed that. He signed a 10-year transportation plan, which is key into that caller's earlier comments about infrastructure. That is sort of the state's response, state's infrastructure plan for roads and bridges. But then he's had some vetoes. So he vetoed last Friday the minimum wage. There was no surprise there that minimum wage hike, which would raise it to $12 an hour in a matter of a few years. He has opposed that in the past. Democrats say that the minimum wage is more necessary more than ever now, and Republicans say it's harmful more than ever now. It just depends on how you look on its impact on businesses. Mm-hmm. He also vetoed a dental benefit in Medicaid, a bill that would create a dental benefit in Medicaid. He said that he supported it broadly, but that it wasn't the right time given the financial constraints. And this was interesting to me because it's the first of probably many things that we're going to see in the next few months and years about how this pandemic is affecting the budget of the state and kind of what policymakers like the governor and lawmakers do with that. So this was in his veto message, he directly mentioned the loss of revenue to the state. There's been a good, healthy mix. One thing I'll say about the vetoes is we are clearly in an election year, not for the vetoes themselves, but for the language that has been put into the vetoes. The governor has been, let's say, passionate in his vetoes. He's often used the veto messages as an opportunity to rebuke the lawmakers and the process that Democrats use to pass things. In one veto, he kind of said that the entire process was unfair and that, he opposed it because the process was bad. So it's gotten a lot more fiery. There's a lot more tension between mm-hmm. sides than you even normally see.
And speaking of vetoes, Annie Ropeek, late last week, you covered Governor Sununu vetoing a clean energy plan. That veto was expected, but can you fill us in on the details?
Yeah, this is just the latest in a long series of clean energy vetoes of bills, mostly sponsored by Democrats, sometimes bipartisan. And Ethan is right. You can tell that this is a campaign issue for Governor Sununu in the way he writes his veto messages. You can also see it in the way that Democratic leadership, including gubernatorial candidate Dan Feltes, respond to these vetoes. So, clean energy adoption and climate change are definitely on the rise as issues in that race. And so this latest bill that we're talking about was an expansion of the state's renewable portfolio standard, which dictates how much clean energy or zero, low or no carbon energy that the utilities have to use in their fuel mix. And this is how states sort of set their goals for how they're going to decarbonize their energy systems. So just to put ours in perspective, this would have raised our RPS to about 57% by 2040. So we would have been getting more than half of our energy from clean sources by 2040. It also notably would have expanded our solar requirement, which right now stands at 0.7%. This is the year where that levels out at 0.7%. Sununu called this and has used this language before, that expanding that would be a handout to the solar industry, which has struggled a lot in New Hampshire during the pandemic, in part because we have these kinds of low goals for solar expansion. Mm-hmm. And then just to compare this to a few other states, right now Massachusetts is ramping up to 80% by 2050 renewable adoption. Maine has an 80% by 2030 goal, 100% by 2050. The lowest, the closest to us is Rhode Island, which is 39% by 2035. So I think Democrats increasingly are seeing this as a barrier to decarbonization in New Hampshire. And right now, our 25% standard ends in 2025. So I think we can expect to see this come back in the next couple of years.
And Annie, you also reported on the state launching a broad effort to find ways to lower air emissions in New Hampshire. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so you heard it here first. I'm calling this the Emish Commish. It's the Emissions Commission.
Such a great name.
Thank you so much. I agree. So this is really interesting. This is it was a study committee bill that died in the session, as many bills did. And it was bipartisan from Democrat Senator Tom Sherman and Republican Jeb Bradley. And when that bill got tabled, they basically agreed that this was an important enough issue and had enough broad support that they would go ahead with an ad hoc version of that commission. So they've put this together just in the past few weeks. They've got everyone from the auto dealers and the Business and Industry Association to all of the top environmental groups in the state. They've got all the top health and medical groups in the state, a bipartisan group of legislators. They've got the Governor's Office of Strategic Initiatives, Department of Environmental Services. It's really a who's who, including some groups that don't always agree on climate policy. And they're going to meet a handful of times through the end of the year, take public comment over Zoom, and look from a health perspective at how to lower emissions in New Hampshire. So Senator Sherman really frames this as sort of a patient's first approach to addressing climate change, that, you know, this can be a two-for-one, a win-win is the way he described it, that we can lower harmful emissions, carbon dioxide, methane, mercury, that kind of thing. Improve patient outcomes, save money on health costs, and address climate change all at the same time. And this group's goal is to recommend some legislation that would do that for next session. So this is sort of like an out-of-session approach to an issue that hasn't gotten a lot of traction in the legislature, in part because of vetoes from the governor, like we've talked about. But I think it's really interesting to see the governor's energy policy folks on board with this. Senator Sherman said the governor himself hasn't said anything good or bad about this commission, so we'll see where it goes. And I'm looking forward to covering their first meeting next Thursday.
Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter and lead reporter on NHPR's new climate reporting project, By Degrees. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks so much.
And Ethan DeWitt, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor, thank you for being on the program.
Great to be on.
Listeners, you can find links to all the stories we discussed on the Roundup today at nhpr.org. This has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks for listening. And now let's check in with our summer raffle.